the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
AV Week is produced and distributed through a partnership with Rave Publications and AV Nation. For more information, go to ravepubs.com/AV Nation. This is AV Week, episode 54, recorded Friday, August 17th, 2012. The Gray Side of the Force.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
Brain Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. It is time for AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tim Albright. I am your host. Thank you so much for joining us. This week, we have three very talented and very intelligent human beings, because I'm not one, so they're going to make up the bulk of the brain power here. With us this week is Harry Mead. He is, if the last name sounds familiar, his wife is Miss AV Dawn Mead, but he is an AV professional in his own right. He is the implementation engineer with Ultra Electronics Criticom. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Also with us is Kelly Perkins. She is the marketing and communications manager for Vadio. See if I can get that out. How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing well.
It is Friday, thankfully. And last but not least is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage and one of my right-hand men here at AV Nation. How are you, sir?
Hello. I'm fine.
Hello.
Hello.
One quick thing just to get it out of the way. Harry has the unique distinction of being one of the individuals who took the CTSD test with me at the exact same time. I'm just going to say that he has one and I don't. So. And I'm still bitter. Today we're going to talk about...
See, and I made a promise to Dawn that I wasn't going to bring that up today.
Oh, no, no. I'll lay it right out there, dude. You got me over a barrel completely forever on that. I don't care if I ever eventually get it. You still got me. Today we're going to talk about AMOLEDs because I have a Mead on, and so I have to talk about, you know, LED and AMOLED technology. What the heck happened to FireWire, which is an interesting question posed by a post on CE Pro's website. Also going to talk about Sharp and a really huge big LED in the commercial space and whether or not it's even intelligent to make commercial LEDs. And also talk about a couple different webinars we have coming up at various locations. But first, we're going to talk about the Olympics. Yay! And I know that everybody's probably tired of it right now. But yeah, I know. But a couple different articles. First was an article in Gizmodo about how you're going to watch the Olympics. Technically, the next time in the Olympics in Rio. And basically, it's this. And all kidding aside and all slamming, you know, NBC for their 5 and 10 and 24-hour delays on the actual live events. Basically, they're saying that, you know, Gizmodo is saying that, yeah, 3D was kind of there this year. Not a whole lot of Britons watched it because the BBC really pushed the 3D thing. Not a whole lot of them tuned into it. Yeah, they've got 8K and 4K coming down the line, but really what you're going to do is you're going to see a lot of HD, and you're going to see a lot of streaming. George, we'll start with you on this one. Two questions, actually. First, you think they're right, and you know we've bashed NBC enough, but do you think that the fact that it's in this hemisphere... What, you know, in the Western Hemisphere, do you think there's going to be a lot more streaming now as opposed to maybe Beijing or London if the technologies were the same?
I certainly hope so, because I missed out on most of it because I don't watch the stuff at night. I think they made it. Yeah, well, they got criticized roundly by at least the social community, right, about this. Everybody was complaining that they couldn't watch it when they wanted to watch it, and I think it's kind of silly that you can't watch something live that's of such. Right, a big thing. I think the problem is that NBC has to be able to find a way to monetize that. That's really what the problem is. I mean, if you listen to what NBC said this year, they went, yeah, we know. But guess what? We've got the highest rated Olympics ever. We've got the most revenue for Olympics ads ever. And they still lost money. Yeah. So they've got to find a way to make that revenue or return on investment in it. And it's not just a public service. I know we'd all like it to be a public service, but it's not. And that's therein lies the problem, right? I mean, they have to find a way to monetize it. And my question is, the way that they found to monetize it, does it inherently change how the internet and media is distributed to us before they can actually make money off of it?
Well, Harry, George makes a good point. You know, they are still losing money hand over fist, and yet NBC can say, you know what, guys, you know the Twitterverse quote unquote complained, but we still have the largest numbers ever. Is that, you know, the fact that a network can say, you know, you guys can, you know, this little small contingency over here can complain all they want, but we still have an audience, so you guys can continue to complain. Do you think that they're going to say, you know, continue to complain, we're going to go about our business and doing it as we please?
Well, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. Because I can only see it growing in the people that are complaining.
Okay.
Because it was pretty loud last year, but apparently, I mean, it depended on who you were talking to, because some people aren't clued into it at all. I mean, I think pretty much, I don't know Kelly, but I imagine that the four of us are fairly clued into all the stuff that's going on. So we would be clued into all the complaining that was going on social media and everything else. And there was a lot of people, because it's a more global world, there are a lot of people that are talking to each other going, hey, did you see? I mean, it was silly to try and keep the results. I mean, even to the point where they had the ad for the chick being interviewed on the Today Show the next day for her gold medal right before her race that she hadn't won the gold medal yet.
Yeah.
Well, I had to shut the alerts off on my phone because I kept getting alerted from AP and all over the place.
It's funny. That's something that they kept saying, though, is that they knew that a lot of people were watching the results on all these little apps, and yet the people seemed to be coming back and still watching it on the 3-hour, 6-hour delay or whatever it was.
Well, that's where I was. I would see during the day, oh, look at that. The men's or the women's team broke the record for the 4x100 relay or whatever, and they completely demolished it. And I'm like, oh, cool. I want to watch that later.
Yeah, and I definitely watched them almost every night. And I think for most of the events, I already knew who won.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing that really annoyed me was the fact that all of the good stuff was between 10:45 and midnight.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I got so little sleep during the friggin' Olympics because I wanted to watch what was going on, and the streaming sucked.
Okay, so let me ask you guys this.
I think that's being polite to it, though.
Well, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, it was clean for a broadcast show.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Harry.
I'm trying to aid in the editing process.
I don't have much energy right now, so editing it will be difficult this weekend. you guys raise an interesting point, because I am the exact opposite of you three. If I know the results, I'm not going to watch. I don't sit around watching the Super Bowl from 1986, even though from 84, 85, even though I'm a huge Bears fan. I only need to see them win it once. If I know the results, I don't watch. But I'm obviously unique in that, because you guys are saying, you know, even though I knew the results, or, you know, like Harry, you know, they broke a world record, I want to see that. I, more than one occasion, my wife is all excited watching some gymnastic thing or some this, that, and the other, and I'm over here on my iPad watching something else, you know, streaming like Amazon or something like that, and she's like, don't you want to see this? And I'm like, no, I know what happens. You know? So, Kelly, is that just the uniqueness of Americans, or, you know, where you have a small population who, A, don't want to watch it because they know, and B, are on Twitter, so those are the yahoos who are complaining, and you've got this other larger contingency who is okay with what NBC is doing?
I mean, I think it's kind of up to everybody. I mean, everybody has their own personal opinion. You know, I have a coworker who you know, I got one of the alerts on my phone about Michael Phelps breaking some records, you know, and I was like, oh, cool. And I told my coworker about it. And he's like, don't tell me. Don't tell me. I'm watching it tonight. And it's like, and how I feel about it, it's like, give me a break. You know, you're going to hear it from everywhere. You know, like you said, it's on social media. You know, it's being talked about before you can watch it. And if you can't get the streaming right, then what do you expect?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have to watch it on TV. And if there's a delay, there's a delay. I mean, I don't think people are going to stay up, get up at 4 a.m. to watch it. What do you guys think? You were saying, I think, Harry, you said that, you know, it was on till midnight where you are.
Well, go ahead, Harry. Okay.
It was. And actually, it was funny because apparently some of the local, not local here, but some of the local NBC sportscasters around were complaining because it's a completely taped show, yet still Costas was going over past midnight.
Well, yeah.
It's like, really? You can't narrow it down a little bit?
Give it that live feel. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's a question, though. With the live streaming and the people saying I couldn't stream it, but I did get a huge audience for it after hours, I wonder if next Olympics, if the American team is not as proficient or prolific, as it were, in getting gold medals, if you would see an ebbing off of people watching it live but not delayed. We got lucky this year. We were the top winners, right? The Americas were the top winners of medals in this Olympics.
That's a very good point.
If it turns out differently, what would the numbers reverse?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It might reverse for some of the lesser known and watched sports.
You mean like curling?
That's winter, but yes.
Oh, sorry. Badminton.
Like volleyball, which they showed every day.
There's
a reason they show volleyball. Let's be honest about that.
No, the indoor volleyball.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was kind of boring.
That was kind of boring.
It's like, okay, I get it. We have apparently the number one women's volleyball team for the indoor volleyball. That's cool. Show it during the day. That's great. You do your thing. I mean, they had 6 or 7 channels that I got that were all running Olympic stuff.
Yeah.
So you were able to go back and forth and you could see different things. Some of it had a feel of ESPN 8 the Ocho of just some of these sports. It's like, okay, yeah. And I mean, I even wrote, I said, when did dirt bike riding get into the Olympics?
I have a better one for you. When did speed walking become an Olympic event?
When did speed walking get so damn violent?
They were given like red cards and yellow cards. I'm like, am I watching, you know, football or soccer? Am I watching speed watching or speed walking? I don't know. That one kind of got me.
Yeah.
There's some weird sports.
That one, and they were doing it around the Buckingham Palace, so I felt like I was in European vacation. Look, kids, big bin. There's Parliament.
But they could have very easily made the evening show a highlight show of, okay, this is the best stuff that happened today.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to show, I mean, and in their effort to do some of this, they did leave out some of the good stuff too, because in just coming to mind in women's gymnastics, team finals, the reason that they only had to get a certain score on the last apparatus was because two Russians literally did face plants on the floor.
Yeah.
But you didn't see that. So it was, yeah, so they were building up suspense and stuff when the people who were commenting on it as it was happening, there was none of that. There was, oh, okay, well, here's the point standing so far, and yada, yada. But
not the context in which that they were in which they were saying this is why we do it tape, you know, a tape delay is to give you context. Well, they didn't give you that context.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like,
I wish,
okay,
I would have seen that.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, look it up on YouTube.
That sounds like an SNL skit waiting to happen.
Yeah, the one little Russian chick does this flippity 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 flip, bam.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, God.
I was like, holy crap. Anyway, the they could have very easily shown events twice, even. Show the stuff as it's live. Show the stuff live. Show the big stuff live if it's as it's going on. And then show the... Show the high rating stuff in the high ratings time, but show the other events live as they're going on instead of giving us 14 more hours of volleyball between Eastern European countries.
Yeah, that Harry makes a very good point, because they're obviously not going to lose viewership, because people were obviously still tuning in even though they knew the results of the various matches and races and stuff. So, all right, enough Olympics for the next 4 years, or 2 years, I guess, because we have winters in 2 years. From our partners over at Rave Pubs comes an interesting article that kind of piqued my interest. And then Harry, you know, when we send the articles out, Harry's like, ooh, I want to talk about this because it's really interesting. And it is interesting. I'm going to talk this out with you guys and see what your take on it, because I have a little bit different spin on this. What it is we're talking about is AQAV. And AQAV is basically, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong on this, is almost like ISO 9000 type standards for integration, which is a really cool thing and a really great thing. But Harry, we'll start with you on this. This AV 9000, this is AQAV. Is it a good idea? And do you think that we as an industry are poised, I guess is the best way to put this, to embrace this and run with this?
Yes and no.
Ah, see.
Yes, it is a good thing. Yes, it is needed. No, I don't think we are poised for everybody to take it on, because I think that there are too many people who have, well, I've always been doing it this way. Why do I need to have a standard? And it's unfortunate. Because I took their class, Mario Maltese and his son, I took their class at Infocom this year on, it was called Eliminating Punch List, but it's basically it was AV or AQAV / AV 9000.
Mm-hmm.
And it can increase your profit center or profit margins to not screw up jobs and to not sit there on the ends of jobs, because the hardest thing about an AV integration job is finishing it. It's the last 5%.
It's that last mile.
And if you've got valid numbers that you're aiming for, that you can run tests and say, The audio comes in at 15 dB above noise threshold. These contrast ratios are there. These distances are there. And you just check it off. Check, 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 check. Okay, the room checks out. Okay, now they can adjust it to their comfort, but you've provided the room that you said in your sales documents that you're going to provide. And it's easily verifiable. Instead of, well, you get one person in there, well, I think it's too loud. And then you get the next person, oh, I think it's too soft. Or, oh, can you do anything about this screen? Or it's like, no. It's set up exactly the way to standards, how it is supposed to be set up. If you guys want to change it from standards, this will be the change order to do it.
Okay, let me ask you this, Harry. Let's say that I'm, you know, I'm a 200-year-old, you know, AV integrator. I've been doing this forever and a day. I've been doing it the exact same way since before you were born, Harry Mead, CTSD. Tell me why I need to change and embrace this AQAV. Did I stump you?
No, I have the TV on and Vikings came on and it completely derailed my thought pattern.
Anyway. Vikings as in like football or Vikings as in men in big hairy hats?
Big hairy hats with horns.
Okay, there we go. That's acceptable.
Yes.
Could be considered the football team too.
No, that's the fans.
I'm from Minnesota. I can say that.
You can.
That's the fans of the football team have the hats. Yes, you should look into this, because what you'll do is you'll find that problems that you've either never been able to get figured out, or you just avoid doing certain things because you can never get it to work. If you use the math will make it work.
Okay.
Jordan, so you can improve your installations.
Math will set you free.
Jeez.
Yeah. Well, I'm in agreement with Mr. Mead. Here's what I see happening with most people is that, yes, this is a good thing. Yes, standards are great. But what most people have problems with is they'll agree in principle, but getting their companies, which are already sort of on the margin, on the edge, and even though you're saying this will save you and make you more profitable, that effort to get the time and the investment to make the transition is like changing the direction of a water wheel in a sawmill, right? An old sawmill.
100% agree.
It's not an immovable force, but it's as close as you're going to get to absolute zero in space, right? I mean, it's a really tough thing to do, especially for a small company. And I think it's harder for a small company because they're really just running and gunning all the time. A larger company might have an ability to change different parts of its company as it goes along and transition slowly. But, you know, the normal integrator, the normal installer, is going to have a lot of trouble with this. It's sort of like why a lot of companies aren't ISO 9000. It's not just the money to do it. It's the time and getting it to work while still making a profit. And it's a hard one. And I think in the end it is the right thing to do. But, man, it's sort of like telling somebody that they have to dig up their entire yard and replace all the plumbing so that they're going to get less of a water bill. Yes, it would help. But, man, the time and effort to get that done is just – it's daunting.
Okay, Kelly, you work for – you are our resident manufacturer today. The other two are our integrators and you know, show control guys, and they're on the front lines. You're our resident manufacturer. As a manufacturer, there are obvious benefits to you guys doing this. But how – first of all, do you think this is a good idea? And secondly, if you think it's a good idea, how would you encourage your dealers to go down this road?
I think it's a great idea, because then we wouldn't have to make 2,500 resolutions for each one of our switchers or mixers or, you know, because there isn't a standard. So I mean, even just setting up our equipment for trade shows to work with other equipment, it's daunting trying to attempt to, you know, make sure everything is at this right resolution and this won't work if this isn't at this resolution. And I think it's great, because I think it would really, I think it would save an integrator's time immensely. I mean, if there were standards for any type of standards in the industry, you know, I mean, think how much time you would save in the field.
No, that's true. The one thing that keeps coming to my head is my buddy Kevin Iselli's statement is the one good thing about standards is that there's so many of them.
Yes.
You know, and that it is his tongue in cheek thing out of it, but the thing is George and I have had this conversation, and even on the air we've had it, you know, the whole thing about, you know, RS-232. We're still fighting about, was it too hot, George?
Well, that's XLR for audio, but I'm, yes, sorry. To pin 2.3, but you're right, pin 2.3 for transmit or receive.
Yeah.
I just went through this actually with a lovely Cat5 converted HDMI box for 232 also. Their box goes in pin 2, comes out pin 3.
Well, yeah, I dealt with the exact same thing.
The transmitter does one side, the receiver does another. Yep. And they're, you know, the argument was, well, DTE, DCE versus, I'm like, oh my God, you're going to kill me. 3.5 hours of my life, gone. Because it's not documented. Granted, I would have read it, I swear. IRTFM, I do. But man, oh man. Yes, so.
That's our number one phrase here.
IRTFM.
only from a manufacturer standpoint, they drop the I and just make it a command.
That is true.
All right, you're listening to AV Week, and I'm not going to edit that one out. Harry Meads with us, Kelly Perkins, and George Tucker. Something actually that me and my buddy Don Mead, that will go round and round and
and stand in line for is the newest, greatest LED TV as soon as they make it available and it doesn't cost me $20,000. But something that came out this week, which kind of bummed me out, especially from AV Network, the new AMOLED TV costs 10 times as much as an LCD. 10 times. Good Lord. Well, if it costs $100, maybe that's $1,000. It's not bad, isn't it? That's $1,000, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
George, you know what? I've been waiting for a freaking LED TV that's within anybody's price range for almost 10 years now. And this just kind of put a big cloud on my parade. Whether it's AMOLED or, you know, and AMOLED is active matrix, organic. Are we going to see this thing, AMOLED or LED, anytime in our lifetimes in a reasonable price range?
Well, if my year-end prediction from the end of the year show states anything, oh, this is the year of OLED in any form.
Yes.
So, yes, I think so. like they said, also going back to the Olympics thing, they are predicting by 2016 that OLED of an or a oh god, I can't even
a
do that
version of
phrase.
It.
Yes, this thing AMOLED will be available by 2014 for the mass consumer, maybe the higher end mass consumer, but still there. So, I think yes, I think there's lots of possibilities for this. And if you read the very difficult article, the way it's phrased and how they were doing it. For some reason, I wanted the AV professional to wrap it. It just felt like somebody was trying to wrap it when they were writing it. It just read it again, so I swear.
Why, like, oh, indium, gallium, zinc oxide isn't confusing at all?
Really? So you need to wrap it to understand it.
Okay, what? I'm sorry, what rhymes with zinc oxide?
I'm almost positive it's done in iambic pentameter. I'm not quite sure yet.
Holy cow.
But I think there is a time for it, yes, because of the vividness that it was going to provide and the increase in apparent resolution, you're going to see a push to do this, especially with demand up. So, yes.
All right, George, are you get or George, Harry, are you getting Dawn one for Christmas?
No,
dang
not
it
at the moment.
Oh,
however,
the question is which year?
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
this year.
Which Christmas. However, I would challenge you to go back to 10 years ago. And find the article that said new LCD TV costs 10 times more than plasma to produce.
Okay.
I would imagine that it existed because they were expensive as crap when they came out.
That is true, yeah.
So to me, this was mostly a non-story.
Okay.
Because it's, oh, it's new technology. Yeah, it costs more. And you get bleeding edge always costs more.
Well, here's my question to that. Was LED that much of a promise for that long that people were sort of pining for it and going, oh God, not another person thinking they can do it? I don't think there was that long of a curve, or maybe I'm just having selective memory, but
well,
this seems to be that OLED has a longer potential, like, oh, this is the greatest thing. We'll see you in 10 years.
Well, I think that part, yes. I mean, you're right. The leading tale of this is rather long, but I thought that, and again, this is my own gray matter, you know, playing tricks on me, maybe. I thought the promise of LED was, you know, it didn't use as much consumption, you know, as much energy as plasma, so that was the promise of LED, or LCD, rather. Or am I
right, but again, I don't remember how long the lead time or trailing, the beginning edge of it was before we actually saw mass market products.
Probably 2 months.
Well, and back then, energy consumption wasn't as big an issue.
Yeah.
So it even if it was being promised for that, I mean, that wasn't a selling point.
Depending on what state you were in. I mean, California was already on the high horse about that,
yeah,
8 years ago, 9 years ago.
Well, that's California.
But still, but I'm just saying it's all in relativity.
I was going to say, reference hippie conversation from earlier.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
I'm not.
The answer is aye.
The answer is 42, but continue.
I don't know a whole lot about OLED screens other than they're flexible and they're supposed to be way better. I mean, is it worth it that they're 10 times as much more than an LED? I mean,
yes. They're gorgeous. I will send you an email or a link to a YouTube video. And, okay, it's shot with a regular camera, so the resolution, it doesn't quite come through. but it's still, I mean, it's markedly better than any other display I've ever seen. It's gorgeous. And okay. Yes, it's flexible, and yes, it can do all of those things. One of the parts of the video, they're actually they're pounding this this panel with a sledgehammer. And it's obvious, it's not doing anything. The flexible part is not really that cool to me. Yes, that's cool, and I don't mean to downplay it. It's just the vividness of everything. I mean, it reminds me of the first time I saw an HD TV with HD content on it. It's that much it's that much better. Personal opinion.
I just had the vision as you were explaining and answering Kelly's question of that scene in Airplane where he hands the tower guy. See what you can make of this.
I can make a hat.
Oh, I can
make a bow.
I don't know. For some reason, I just had that vision in my head.
I speak jive. All right.
It's OLED. I can make a hat.
It's a boat. Well, that was the thing. Gary Kay and I on our daily show a couple weeks ago, I asked him and kind of posed it to our panel last week or week before last about, you know, the technology we see at these opening ceremonies. And that was one of the coolest things I saw 4 years ago, not to go back to the Olympics, but was this flexible OLED kind of unrolling and unfurling. It was the scroll during the Beijing opening Olympics. And yes, that's very cool. And again, I don't mean to downplay it, but for me, again, when I'm buying something for my house or for an installation, I'm looking for, you know, performance. And for me, performance for a display is color saturation. It's the darks of the black and how vibrant the colors are. And for me, there's nothing I've seen yet that tops OLED.
So,
if
you can get to the point where you're not, I think that this whole deal is if you can get to the point where there's not a backlight, then you can get all the blacks and everything else the way that they should be, and your contrast ratios go where they should be. Because anytime you've got a backlight shining through something, it's never going to be true black because there's always going to be light leakage.
Amen, brother. Which is why I prefer plasma over LCD, which is why I don't, LCD is like my least favorite display.
I was going to say, I've got a 10-year-old 50-inch Pioneer plasma sitting on my wall, so I don't even want to...
Nah, way to go, Harry.
I was going to say, granted, it kind of says USA in the corner after 10 years, but hey, whatever. Hey, whatever.
actually, speaking of that, let's go on to another story. Sharp debuted this week, a really huge, gigantic commercial grade LED. And kind of my first question to you guys are this, and it's cool. It's up to 46 inches, which is not ginormous. It's not like the 100-inch Pioneer that we saw at Infocom last year, but it's still pretty good size. Harry, I mean, you work for an integrator. Is it time for us to stop making and stop installing commercial grade displays? Because first of all, they're more expensive. And secondly, I mean, everybody in the industry that writes or pontificates has said that, you know, the commoditization of displays has come and gone. I mean, you can buy them in 4-packs at Sam's, for crying out loud. Should we stop making and putting in commercial grade displays?
Well, if you want it to work every time in your system, yeah, you need a commercial grade because you got the right control at that point. I don't see 232 control on a lot of the Resi ones, and to me, that's a major non-selling point. Because I need something that I know is going to turn on and tell me that it's on every time. Okay. And I need to know what input it's on, and I need to not just scroll through the inputs with an IR code. Go ahead.
An interesting question for you, Harry, because I just went through this as well. And by the way, just as we were talking about my having trouble with that little box, the guy just called me and asking me if I got a solution. So here's the thing, though, with those 232 ports, something we experienced, and we were putting in monitors for a call center. We actually bought these monitors off of a deal, partnership with a vendor, and we put them up, and when they were 232 control, great. Guess what? They have that power saving feature that they have to shut off.
Ew.
After a certain amount of time, and guess what it also turns off? Mm-hmm. The board that feeds the 232 port. So a lot of this stuff, and there was really no way to defeat it, actually. There was a way to defeat it, but it was a super secret firmware that nobody else knew about, and it doesn't exist. I don't know anything about it. But that's how you got around it. So the 232 thing, even though we're seeing it's still viable, and we had this argument earlier, it becomes sort of a moot point when they're saying, well, when it shuts down, it shuts down. So commercial grade is great because it lasts longer and it's durable, and it takes some kid in a school smacking it or spilling her, you know, milkshake on it, for goodness sakes. But the 232 argument in versus, you know, commercial versus, say, residential, it's really starting to be moot point because they're getting rid of it by atrophy.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate here, because this really is my opinion on this. According to this article, it was on Rave's site. The 46-inch is MSRP is $1,500. Okay, let's say that that's what you as the integrator sell it for. I can go to Walmart right now, and I know this off the top of my head because I've been looking at them, or Amazon, and I can buy a 46-inch, pretty good, you know, top one or two level display for about $500. You're telling me that this thing is going to last three times as long, and I Harry, I'll give you the 232, but 90% of these are going to have some sort of IP interface, and I'm pretty sure that I can get IP control down. I may not, and that I'll give you. But is that really worth, is the control over 232 worth three times as much, and is it going to last me three times as long, or is it going to last me twice as long, in which case I can just buy another one and still only out $1,000?
MSRP is a figment of your imagination.
Wow, okay.
Well stated.
All right, never mind.
I was going to say, I know we have a manufacturer on the line, but MSRP is a joke. You can't sell anything at MSRP because people will go to Amazon and buy it for a third of the cost.
But I can't buy a commercial grade on Amazon. You make a very good point as to reasons why to buy it, but I can't get that at Amazon. I have to buy it from you. I have to buy it from my buddy Michael, who is an integrator in St. Louis. I have to buy it from George. You know, I can't get an Extron switcher or a Crestron, you know, Pro 2 on Amazon.
That stuff, the stuff that's more specialized, yes, but displays, I've had people try and give me that display. I mean, and we have to come in. I'll give an example. A lot of if cost is 50% MSRP,
yeah,
we have to come in at like 10% or less on our sell price in order to be able to get in the door. Okay, then you're only dealing with 800 versus 500, and then you can make a little bit better argument.
Okay, just for the record, I stand corrected. You can get it on Amazon.
I was going to say.
For less than $1,000, I'll just say that much.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's perfectly valid. But you do, it's just, to me, I've always had, and that 232 shutting off thing, that's an Energy Star thing. And that's annoying as her. Just yeah. Because it's like, okay, we're taking away the functionality of the unit because we're trying to hit a particular Energy Star mark. And that just annoys the living daylights out of me.
Just for the record, you can also get Vadio products on Amazon. So I just want to throw that out there, too. Sorry, Kelly works for Vadio, so...
I was going to say, you can buy just about anything legal and illegal.
Let's type in Crestron just for the heck of it. Just yeah,
oh, yep, buy Vadio products on Amazon?
Yeah. Yeah, no Crestron. Yeah, I typed in Vadio on Amazon, and it brought up a bunch of you guys' cameras and stuff.
Oh, I thought it was just eBay.
Well, eBay is kind of a given, but yeah, some of your PTZ stuff is on Amazon. All right. Speaking of your PTZ stuff, this week Vadio upgraded their IP camera control for your guys' software. Your free version is at version 1.01. So Kelly, talk about that for a second, and Harry would like to follow behind you and throw flower petals and play the trumpet because he's really excited about it.
Well, when we first released the camera, it had IP control on it. So the web pages were there. What we really did is, in this upgrade version, now you can display the camera's IP address. So when you plug it in, you can actually display the physical camera's IP address versus trying to guess what it is or going through the network or whatnot. So that was more of that's really it.
Well, and Harry, you and I were talking about this over email in exchanging the stories. I see IP control over for cameras and for everything else. It's kind of a no-brainer. When I first started in the industry, one of the first two or three products I ran into was Crestron and Extron products that had basically little web pages. And I came from the world of broadcast, and I had my fair share of HTML training and dealing with, you know, some basic page display and page design. And the fact that these devices, this little device I can hold in my hand, produced its own little web page was fascinating to me. And now you've got a camera that does the same thing. I mean, is this, Harry, do you see this as a sign of things to come for not just cameras, but for other stuff too?
Yes. In a word. IP is how it's all going to go. Okay, you're going to have control, transmission, all over a form of IP. What I think that Vadio has done with this particular bit, with their USB cameras, and is they're hastening the demise of the VTC hardware.
Okay.
Pretty much all of our USB products and most of our other products that we're designing, you know, over the next 12 to 18 months will all have internal embedded web server pages. So it's something that we're going to start just putting in all of our products, just the camera.
Oh, very cool.
Now, here's my question, though. Are you going to allow third-party control to use the protocols that you're using for your IP control?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Wow.
Because then there you go.
We're trying to make it easy for you guys.
So, I mean, that's how you take that's how you get AMX and what have you, and now you can just control everything over IP, and you only need a little controller, and you don't even need to buy a touch panel, even though they get really cool looking touch panels now. And you get to the point where you've got the BYOD, bring your own device, where you have the touch panel that comes up on your phone that you control that each person controls the room with.
All right,
and that's it.
And it's just it's all moving in that direction. And yes, trumpets, rose petals.
All right, George. Harry brings up a really good point. So this year at Infocom, one of my favorite control companies, and I've never made bones about this, is Crestron. And they had their latest, greatest, they're one of their biggest processors is called a Pro 2. They're coming out with a Pro 3 now. It has all these, you know, they're 232. I think their Pro 2 has like five or six 232 in the back, and they've switched that to Phoenix connectors, which I'm really excited about. And all this other stuff. Are you telling me maybe if Harry's right, we don't need a Pro 2 anymore? We don't need something that big. We need maybe, you know, a smaller version of that that has a bigger engine on the IP side and maybe a smaller smaller computing power on the 232 side.
Yes. Look at Core 3. That's basically what it was going out to, and it was fewer pieces, but it had Ethernet on it. Look at the Pro 2s that had the addition of the LAN cards. Everything is going IP. And it's funny, I find it, because Vadio, again, I don't know the product line that well, so forgive me. But when somebody like Lifesize and the other telepresence companies are actually offering free or very cheap interface software plus controls, they're all going that way. It's not going for the major hardware anymore. It's all about getting the market share and getting the user base. So, yeah, everything's going to go Cat 5 or Cat 6e.
Or Cat 7.
And if you're
one more.
If you're controlling it over IP, you know, your end user that's using it, what are they going to know how to use? You know, a complex control system or their iPad?
No, that's a very good point. That's the one thing that all of these guys have in common is the fact that, you know, you can access them whether it's through an iPad or whether it's through your desktop. If you have an IP address, you can talk to these things, which is really cool, a really cool thing.
Well, but the one problem with that is that now if you have my video camera has an IP address and a control, and my projector has an IP address and a control page, and my DVD player or Blu-ray player has an address and a control page, and all of this other stuff, now you've got to surf to all of these different pages to do. So there's still going to be a market to unify those simple controls. But branching into a almost separate thing, control system programmers are going to have to make it easy, make it easier and more simple for everybody to do things on their touch panels and such, and make it more like their iPhone, or make it more like their tablet or what have you, or make it controllable from their tablet. So you have a single IP address to go to then talk IP to all of these different things.
Very cool.
Makes sense.
It makes complete sense.
And I do have a question about it, though. And I'm thinking about, it's not just the local Ethernet, it's the actual transmission over Internet, because you're going from point to point, and you're not going to use something like this, at least, from room to room. Maybe building to building in an intranet, you know, a campus. But is this not a stealth way for the people to do some throttling, saying this is one of the broadcast issues that is facing the Internet, and this is one of those sort of subtle pressures on throttling bandwidth and making it a hierarchy, not an open source?
Well, it depends on the accessibility. I mean, because there are, you know, like us on our campus, we have a closed system. Yes, we can get out, and yes, we can get out to the Internet. But the majority of my devices, I can't get to unless I'm on the network. I'm on our network. And so that's one way to kind of mitigate some of what you're talking about, George, which is, you know, this whole wide open free Internet. Well, yeah and no, because there's a drastic difference between somebody surfing for YouTube and somebody trying to access, you know, a CP2E, which is a control processor. Unless you make that available to the outside world, it's not going to be, and so it's not going to affect your bandwidth, I don't think, unless I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I'm looking for like the global bandwidth.
Okay.
And that these products, and I'm not to put Kelly on the spot, but are manufacturers like Vadio saying, I wonder if this is going to be part of the pressure, or are they part of the legal corporate people looking at Washington saying, don't throttle because this will affect our business model? Or is it just something that's not being considered at the moment? Because this stuff will add to the impression that it's tubes, not a dump truck. And, you know, I'm wondering, because it's not just the broadcasters, it's not just the big guns, it's these little markets that are doing all of this stuff on the Internet that eventually will connect it, and that's taking up bandwidth. And is that a pressure on it? I don't know the answer to it, but it's something that just popped into my head as I was listening to it.
Yeah.
Well, but for me, like, what I would see a lot of this is you have to beef up your internal infrastructure. It's not necessarily all getting broadcast. You're going to have to manage it before it leaves the LAN in order to get out. And that's where the main throttling and everything will have to occur. It's internally, you're going to have to be able to beef up your network in order to provide video and do whatever over the internal networks. We're already looking at the fact that we're beefing up our switches and things. We used to put little 5-port Netgear buy it at Best Buy things, and we're not putting those in anymore. We're putting in real Cisco switches. We're doing the real stuff to make sure that the to make sure that we've got the bandwidth for all of these different applications within the room, because I think it's a within the room or within the system thing, not necessarily an internet thing.
No, that's a very good point. You're listening to AV Week with Harry Mead. That was him right there. Kelly Perkins and George Tucker. Cedia is coming up upon us. And one of our buddies, Julie Jacobson, and the gang over at CE Pro have been kind of piquing our interest as to the various people she's sending to Indianapolis to cover the event. And one of them is a gentleman by the name of 39 Cent Stamp, or as Mac, as people know him. He's going to CEDIA for the first time in a long time, and this post kind of piqued my interest even more. It is something that he posted up and basically said, you know, the last time I was at CEDIA, FireWire was the biggest, greatest, next best thing, and I better not hear a darn thing about FireWire. To which someone responded, you know, FireWire became HDMI. Huh? So, I'll put it to you. George, did FireWire become HDMI?
I've been thinking about this ever since I wrote it, and I respect 39 Cent's opinion, but and the guys there to talk to him. But I guess functionality-wise, it's approaching it. I mean, it does do Ethernet capability. It does do video. It does do audio. So it'll do data, video, audio, control. Yeah. So I guess in many ways, but I don't know if it – does it have the throughput to match it? Forgive me. I really didn't even research this, but I mean, I'm used to FireWire because of all the Macs that I use here at the shop. We use a lot of it for the video display systems over, say, HDMI because we can put through more. We think it's more reliable, even though it has a similar type of non-locking connector. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. yeah.
But the reality is that maybe because we're Mac-centric in many ways for our video, that's something we do. And we don't use HDMI nearly as often. But I could see the relativeness of it. But, you know, I got to say, I defer to others. I still see them as viable. So it's sort of like the 232 argument. I still use it a lot. So okay. I don't know what everyone's complaining about.
All right, Kelly, can we say this then? Is maybe HDMI is FireWire's cousin, not necessarily a direct descendant?
I can't even remember the last time I used FireWire.
There we go.
Do they even have FireWire ports anymore?
Not on newer Macs. That technically migrated into Thunderbolt, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, but that's only recent Thunderbolt. So
it's the last year and a half. I mean,
but you've got media servers and Catalyst systems and all this kind of stuff that high-end video people use that are still really reliant upon it, and they're repulsed by the idea of going to HDMI.
Okay. Harry, did FireWire morph itself into HDMI, or is Georgie kind of right where, you know, it's not quite exactly the same?
They aren't exactly the same. I think FireWire is going to morph into Thunderbolt. I think HDMI is the bastardized nephew of FireWire and Thunderbolt. and they're trying to make HDMI more like that, and I think it's just not gonna fly.
Brothers from a different mother.
Well, let me ask you guys this, and this is all kidding aside. If the connector aside, and we can beat up the freaking connector on HDMI all day long, and I'll be first in line to do that. But the transport itself, if it had an actual locking connector, do you think AV professionals would be more apt to embrace HDMI and not beat up on it so much?
Distance limitations.
Okay.
That's the big thing.
Okay.
I'm not even as – because you can get around the connector with the little blue Extron thing.
Oh, jeez.
And just wire tie it to the friggin' piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Well, can't you get around it with anything that uses HD-based T in its product line?
Exactly. it's just – you have to go to HD-based T before you get any distance out of it.
No, that's true.
And or else you have to buy a 100-foot of cable that costs almost $1,000 or something stupid like that.
Okay.
And there's just – it's just – that's bad.
George, if you're going to HD base T, is it HDMI at that point, or is it just digital?
It is HDMI at that point, yes. But, I mean, when you're doing installs or doing something like, you know, education, I guess you would even have the – would you rather run HDMI, or would you rather run HDMI from the source to a box then over Cat 5 through the walls to the destination?
Duh.
Fiber.
Exactly.
Oh, yes. Don't even get me started on fiber.
Fiber.
It's a myth.
I can't field terminate it. No.
Yes, you can.
No, I can't. You can field terminate fiber now.
It's like you the can dark, do all kinds of stuff.
It's like the dark side of the force.
No,
HDMI is the dark side of the force.
Feel that.
It's sort of like the gray side of the force, I would think, you know.
It's kind of the gray, wimpy side of the force.
It's the expensive side of the force. How about that? You guys forget, I work for education. We don't have any money. Last story here on the block here. We talk about, you know, iPads and stuff like that, you know, for everything from control to consumption devices. And this is the first story that came across my desk about telepresence and the iPad. There's a company called Double Robotics Double that is, well, I put on the thing, it's telepresence with legs. And this is just the freaking coolest thing I've ever seen. Okay, so it's $2,500, right? And it puts your iPad on, or somebody's iPad on. It gives you wheels, I guess, is the best way to put this. And you can control it and walk around. Not walk, but walk's the wrong word. Basically,
roll.
Yeah, thank you. You can roll around
in the space.
You can roll around and be someplace else. George, there's a whole lot. The education side of me is going nuts here because I can think of, you know, I have my teacher at the front of the class. Only she's not really there. She's this stick with wheels and her face on the top of an iPad, and she's rolling around the classroom. That I'm having these weird visions of that. Is that like where we're headed here? Where that, and I have a really bad vision of like the scene in The Untouchables, where Capone is walking around the table with a baseball bat, and this version of that. I'm on medication, so it's really weird this week.
The colors.
Is this kind of where we're going with this, or is this something that's kind of kitschy that doesn't really have legs? And I'm sorry for the pun.
I think it does have legs. Although I was going to say halfway through your conversation, like some of the professors I had in college, I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference.
Oh, there it is.
But that being said, I think there's potential here. I don't know if the potential, though, is the replacement of someone in front of you or being remote all the time, but it is a way to visit, I think, certain institutions or certain things as a preview. So I can't get to a museum, but if they enabled certain days where I could roll around and look at stuff and research things from the comfort of my home, yes. I mean, there's a difference between going to the Met and seeing those large paintings up front, up close, and feeling their size, and sort of getting this perspective of a fisheye lens as much as it is from say, a mobile device on a robot. You know, I mean, one of the things that put this is I think NPR did an article about a Wall Street Journal article about this woman, Rachel Emma Silverman, who for about a week or two remoted in from her Texas office to the Wall Street Journal as a robot.
Wow.
Using what is it? I forget what the name of the robot is. The QB82, I forget who makes it, but she talks about how it was very interesting and she could actually go to the water cooler and she was part of the conversations. But there were inherent problems. One, everybody was always, even when they got used to it, it's an oddity to see. All right, maybe that's a comfort level over time and generations. But that it just was an awkwardness that when she got back to work after a couple of weeks, there was a completely different relationship that you could not get through this device.
Hmm.
And the device had issues. I mean, if someone came by and was talking to her and they happened to tap it, the thing fell over. I mean, yes, you could make a robot that wouldn't tip over. But remember, the real estate that it needs to have to make sure it's non-tippable is probably not convenient for, say, your typical workspace.
How does it not run into anything?
I know.
Well, it has sort of those collision avoidance things. And I mean, if somebody jumps out and goes boo, I'm sure it would get knocked. But I'm sure it's not quiet by any means. But my only third thought of that was, you know, is this the future? They asked her, and all I could see was a office buildings full of these remote robots. like nobody goes to work. There's just all the robots going there, and you do your work remotely. And it just didn't make sense to me.
There's a bad.
I felt like I was reading.
Why even have an office?
Exactly. But that. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you extrapolate the end game of this, what do you got? Two people in the office, and the rest of these robots.
There's a Bruce Willis movie about this with this really as a premise. I can't think of the name of it. No.
What, 13 Monkeys or?
No. The replacements, I think. No, not the replacements. I don't know. It's a society full of robots, anyhow. Sorry.
The only thing I could think of was, does anybody watch Big Bang Theory?
Yes.
The episode where Sheldon created a virtual presence device and had his T-shirt hanging on the front of it was wheeling around the he's like, no, I'm in a secure location, keeping my brain safe for future science. And they're like, you're in the bedroom. No, I'm in an undisclosed location. And just walking around, I mean, and trying to interact with Wozniak in a restaurant as a virtual presence device. And just... It seems silly to me. I'm with George on this. There's some things that you just have to see, and you have to be in front of, and you have to actually have human contact. As much as we've tried to take human contact out of the world with Facebook, Twitter, and everything else, you still have to have human contact, and you still have to be able to see what's going on, and you can't just be home and remote all the time because it won't work. And yeah, why have an office at that point if you're going to have all these little virtual presence sticks running around?
Okay.
Yeah, the article, by the way.
Go ahead.
What's the difference between using one of these robots to go to a museum or see something? What's so different about that versus doing like a virtual 360 tour? I mean, other than it's in live time.
Yeah, and you have the ability to independently roam where you want to, when you want to, and linger as long as you can. I mean, those 360 things are still, I guess, maybe they make glasses, but they're anamorphic in certain ways that you just don't get the same sense. At least that's my take. I don't know.
As realistic as a video game environments are now, they should be able to do a 360 tour that is as explorable as a video game environment. And you should be able to do, I mean, if friggin' Warcraft can have little nooks and crannies that you can go explore and look at stuff and talk to people and do it, then why can't the museum?
Well, how accurate is it? I mean, look, if you're talking about a painting, let's say a Rembrandt or something that's hanging in the Met, and it's fairly large, they could possibly try to recreate some of the brushstrokes, but there's nothing like looking at it. And again, it's nothing like looking at it in person, but there's a difference between doing a 360 tour, which I guess is pictures, but it's modified in certain ways. It's digitized and edited in certain ways, stitched together. This is not stitched together. This is you're looking at it as closely and as real you can without being there to touch it. I'm taking a guess here. I'm stabbing in the wind here, but.
Well, let me play devil's advocate on this one, because I can see huge benefits to everybody, you know, staying at home and sending your robots to work. You know, there would be no more workplace accidents. There would be no more sexual harassment. There would be no more, you know, this, that, and the other.
Nice stick you got there.
Oh, be quiet, Harry.
There could still be sexual harassment. You're still talking to people.
Well, yeah, I was going to say about that.
You're not trying hard enough. Jeez.
Well, and then you've got.
We got a winner.
Then you have the other aspect, which is, you know, the sci-fi geek in me that says, you know what? Instead of sending actual astronauts to Mars or to Jupiter or whatever, you send robots with, you know, the people controlling them back here on Earth. And, you know, there's less danger for the actual human being.
I don't know. To do true science, you need human beings involved.
Yeah.
I was going to say, they're good for an advance party, but then basically they can prove that, yes, people can be there, and then you need to send people.
All right.
Because you're gonna run out of things that the little rovers and things can do.
by the way, the article that I mentioned, it was My Life as a Telecommuting Robot.
My Life as
a Rachel S. Silverman.
Very cool.
Yeah, very very interesting article.
All right. Well, I think that's all the problems of the world we can solve for 1 week. So that and, you know, deep space exploration with robots on, you know, iPads on sticks. Yeah,
I want one.
Give that to Gene Roddenberry and see what kind of series he can come up with. So, oh wait, he's dead. Never mind. All right, with us this week on AV Week has been Ms. Kelly Perkins from Vadio. Thank you so much for joining us, ma'am.
Thank you for having me. I learned quite a bit. Thank you, guys.
Wow, that's the first time that anyone's ever said that.
She didn't say the quality of what she learned. She just said she learned.
Oh, yeah, look, I was going to say, it is a quantity over quality.
Okay.
I learned that I really want one of these robot things.
Me too.
And I don't quite know what I'll do with it, but I want one.
Well, it's like the segue. I want one, but I can't ride it to save my life. I fall off of them all the time. Harry Mead has also been with us. He is my favorite CTSD holder of all time. Harry, thanks so much, sir.
I'm going to get the eye just to piss you off.
Oh, that would be... let me know when you take the test. I'll take it just so I can, you know, I can blow a couple $100 more and I'll, you know, fail that one too. George Tucker also has been with us. Mr. Tucker, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Oh, goodness.
You know, I did have a CTSR way back when.
What the freak was that?
Ooh.
That was rental and staging. You learned how to pack a box.
I know about CTSR. I didn't do anything with it, but I know about it.
Seriously?
There you go. See?
That's awesome.
The CTS alphabet. Oh, wow. I had no idea that there was an R. Maybe I was just...
there's no longer, but it was very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my name is Tim Albright. I don't have any of that. Well, I guess I technically have a CTS, so.
Tim.
What?
Nothing.
Yeah, shush. All right. Thanks so much for joining us. Check us out on our website, which is avnation.tv. Avnation.tv. You can check out biographies. A couple blogs are up there and information about our shows. But check out the shows, you can go to our partner's website, which is ravepubs.com/AVNation. ravepubs.com/AVNation. That's all the time we have for AV Week.